This is Howard Husig, Vice President for Policy Research here at the Manhattan Institute, with another of our series of conversations entitled From the Desk of the Dean, appearing on the Manhattan Institute's web magazine Minding the Campus and featuring Herb London, Senior Fellow at the Institute's Center for the American University and the former Dean of the Gallatin College for Individual Study at New York University. Herb, our subject today is college athletics. And there's a lot of ferment among the opinion leaders, shall we say, about college athletics in the wake of the football season. Now it's basketball season. I believe you were, in fact, a college athlete yourself. Am I right?
That is correct. I played at Columbia.
There's a couple of strands to the criticism that's emerging about college athletes, and I'd like to take them one at a time. First, especially when it comes to football and basketball, we see large television contracts for the universities and very remunerative contracts for the coaches. Some of them make more than university presidents. There's a view out there that the student athletes, so-called, are engaged in some form of slavery, that they don't graduate, that they're not compensated, and the time has come to pay them. I wonder if you could reflect both on that immediate question, should they be paid, and the larger situation. Are they oppressed, as it were?
Well, let me start with the first point. It seems to me that when you're talking about student athletes, you're talking about what becomes an oxymoron in most of the Division I teams in the United States, where in fact they're athletes and then perhaps students, but in most instances not students. Of the 44 people that participated in the championship football game between LSU and Alabama, not one of them registered for classes in the spring semester. Now, this clearly suggests to me that we're not talking about people being students. They are athletes, athletes almost entirely. So now the question is, what should we do with these people who are athletes? Now, it seems to me one of the things that you could do is you could have club status. They could be paid. And whether they have an affiliation with the university or not is entirely up to them. But they don't really have to be called students. They don't have to register as students. That is one way to deal with it. Another is to increase the compensation. And in fact, the NCAA is doing that this year with another $2,500 permitted for each student who is now enrolled in a university. But when we have the one-and-done philosophy on the part of many of these athletes, 1 year in college and then let me see if I can get into pro ball, that, it seems to me, is an absurdity. It's an absurdity for the colleges, and it's an absurdity for many of those people who care about being a student athlete. On the other hand, one of the things that concerns me a great deal is what happens to those athletes who play Division I sports and do not end up with a pro team. If they don't get an education, they're lost. And that, I think, is the real tragedy. It's not so much those people who go on and get a pro career. It's those people who are unable to make it in the pros. They played college football. They never really got an education. They were so-called communications majors or basket weaving majors in college, and they have nothing to lean back on when they finally leave the university.
Well, another logical point on that spectrum would be to insist that they be student athletes. That is, that they enroll in serious courses, that there be minimum requirements, and that we insist on there being students as well as athletes. Is that practical? Anything's practical.
Well, I think that it's somewhat impractical when you consider the schedule that people are facing. Let me give you an indication of what was happening. The bowl games all occurred in December. In December, final examinations were taken. In preparation for the bowl games, there were two-day practices. That is, you practiced in the morning and you practiced in the afternoon. You wore pads in the morning, and in the afternoon it was all X's and O's. And so you sat down with the coaches and went through what is the game plan. Now, if you are going to study for final examination, I don't know when you would do it. There is no opportunity to do it. If you're a Division I player playing in one of the bowl games, and by the way, there were more than 50 different bowl games in the United States for Division I teams, so it's not practical. Now, there are players who obviously do engage in classroom study, and there are some who make the All-American Scholastic team, and those people, I think, are really unusual candidates for the future. But by and large, this is not the pattern with most Division I football and basketball players. It's one and done. They're there for the purpose of playing basketball. They're lifting weights in the weight room. The coaches don't care whether they attend classes or not. And in some ways, it's rather tragic. I can remember an interesting illustration of a fellow I knew who played basketball at St. John's, Sonny Dove, who ended up driving a cab in New York. He didn't make a pro team and ultimately committed suicide. Now, that was a very tragic story, but there are many tragic stories of that kind that do not make the newspapers. And these are people who have committed themselves to basketball or football in college and have very little to lean back on when they finally leave the university.
So what you're saying to us is that to change the system, even payment would be a minor change, the whole schedule and ethos of this situation would have to be reconfigured. But let's turn to the National Collegiate Athletic Association and the rules it makes for individual athletes in terms of their eligibility. That's another issue that has surfaced, particularly in the writing of Joe Nocera, the opinion columnist for the New York Times. And Mr. Nocera is waging a crusade, really, against NCAA on the basis that it's limiting the freedom of athletes to enroll where they want, to change schools, to decide if they want to play an extra year or not by limiting eligibility. I'm sure from the NCAA's point of view, they're ensuring fair competition. Is this something we should be concerned about in terms of the freedom of college athletes?
Well, there are egregious examples that have been pointed out by Mr. Nocera of people who deserve eligibility and for a variety of arbitrary reasons are not permitted to engage in college sports. And the NCAA makes those judgments. And again, they can be contested, but by and large, they are sometimes, and not always, but sometimes they are quite arbitrary. And I think that Nocera has a point, but I think it's a point that can be overstated. I think the more essential point is what do college athletics really mean to the very nature of the university enterprise? A lot of money is being generated, but to what degree are academic programs compromised by all of the money that's being generated through bowl games, through March Madness, and through all of the activities that people engage in sports?
And so if you were in the dean's chair at a Duke or at Kentucky or Alabama, would it be your inclination to push back against all of that?
I would push back against it. As I said, I would either opt for club status or I would say I would demand that students attend classes and have something to lean on rather than simply the possibility of playing in the pros, where only a tiny fraction of the players on the field today actually end up with pro contracts. I remember one very interesting illustration. I was never given any special dispensation when I was at Columbia. I had to take all of the examinations. I was always required to attend every class. On one occasion, however, I played in the Detroit Motor Tournament. This was a basketball tournament that took place in December, just prior to final examinations. There was a snowstorm in Detroit. My plane did not land till 3 o'clock in the morning. I had a 9 o'clock economics examination. Lowell Harris was my instructor, who you may know. And Lowell Harris saw me when I walked into that classroom and said, "My God, you can't keep your eyes open." I said, "Sir, I tried very hard to study. I tried to study on the plane, but unfortunately, the plane landed at something like 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. I just took a cab from the airport to get to this class to take this examination, but I didn't have any time to study." He was the only professor in my 4 years at Columbia who said, "Go back to sleep and take the examination tomorrow." That was the only time, the only special favor that was ever done for me. And of course, it was embarrassing not to be able to take the examination, but even more embarrassing to have Dave DeBuscher hit three-point shots. Well, in those days, it wasn't a three-point shot, but hit 30-foot shots against me as I was trying to guard him.
Well, I think being overshadowed by Dave DeBuscher is something you can definitely be forgiven for. Well, thanks, Herb. This has been another in our series of conversations entitled From the Desk of the Dean, appearing on the Manhattan Institute's web magazine, Minding the Campus, and featuring Herb London, senior fellow at the Institute's Center for the American University, and the former dean of the Gallatin College for Individual Study at New York University. For the Manhattan Institute, I'm Howard Husing.